back to Almost Famous Minute, where we're discussing the 2000 Cameron Crowe film Almost Famous, 1 minute at a time. I'm Eric Nash from Watchmen Minute.
I'm Robert Black from Annihilation Minute.
And I'm Mike Lamoth, formerly of the Recasting Couch podcast.
How was your guys' week there on my couch?
Very comfy. Or
couches. You didn't have to share.
Wait, we didn't have to share? Oh, then yeah. Why did we?
Is it a love seat?
I had to put the ottomans out in front. You didn't try to lay lengthwise.
Spooning.
Yeah. Thanks so much for making it back, Mike, as our guest.
Happy to be here.
Good first minute there. A lot of interesting ideas put forth. And Robert back for, as our unofficial with no real responsibility co-host.
I'll try to take responsibility today.
Yeah, right. You better up your game. So this is minute 62. And it starts with Ed drumming his leg and ends with everyone except Russell singing.
Is it just me, or does he look like he's 47 and everyone else looks like they're 23?
It's a rough night.
It's a rough night, right. No, he actually looks like he should be in Spinal Tap.
Yeah.
Every time I've seen the movie, I've been like, yeah, you tried out for Spinal Tap for sure.
So we have a good, the first 12 seconds roughly where... Yeah, no one's singing yet, and it's Larry that comes in singing. But, and like I said, it's Ed, the drummer, with his drumsticks. He just happens to keep around him. I've seen drummers do that, keep them in their cars or something while I've driven with them. And I feel like there's another scene where he has his drumsticks and he's drumming on a back of a seat or something. That's almost what I thought here too, I think, at points, but then I realized, oh yeah, he does have his legs up.
Yeah.
So he's kind of is hitting his legs, I think.
Yeah, my brother, one of my brothers, well, actually both play drums, but one of them is a drummer and my son's a drummer, and it seems to be that drummers incessantly drum, whether they have sticks or not.
That's why they're drummers, they can't help it.
Yeah. Or they just like to drive us crazy. One or the other.
But there are some of those cuts, back and forth. I mean, it's not like Cameron Crowe knew we were going to be doing this minute by minute and segmented these minutes. But, up till that roughly 10, 12 seconds or so in, like at 10 seconds, you got the cut back over to Penny and William. And they're fairly symmetrically looking off to each side from each other at that point.
I like the shot of Plexia and Jeff because they're starting to move to the music. Enjoy it.
Yeah. Yeah. There is a little bit of the head bob.
Well, it's the recognition by everyone that we're going to get into this. I don't know. I love it.
Well, and actually, I think it's, so Larry starts singing and it's that cut back over to Jeff with his eyes. He's like, I see what you're doing. Yeah. We're all going to start singing now. But then my other thought, just a few moments ago before we hit record, was that in rewatching it then, it was like, could there possibly have been a rule on the bus of no singing along with anything we have playing at any point?
Anyone who has that rule on a bus needs to be stopped.
You'd be
that's what buses are for.
Yeah, no, I'm 100% with you. I actually used to sing in multiple singing groups, and I was in a band for a while back in the day. Yeah. So, that would.
I'm just thinking of my school bus, way to and from sports events.
So there's
a song came on, we all knew we're singing.
There is a moment in this minute that we're kind of hovering around now that I wanted to talk about. So there is, it's one of. Again, I don't know if I give Cameron Crowe too much credit or not enough. I'm not sure. And I don't know if this is on purpose or not, but I love this. So the bass player starts singing. Let me back up a little bit. Do you remember back in the, probably 10 years ago, YouTube first kind of came out. There was a video of a dude dancing by himself at a festival, this hill overlooking this absolutely gorgeous, I think it's the Gorge, I think is where it is in California.
That sounds familiar.
this dude by himself. They're clearly at a festival. All these people are sitting on their blankets, and someone just starts videotaping this one guy. He's just dancing by himself, and he is in it. Like, he doesn't care about the world around him. He is in it. And after about a minute or two, some other dude comes running out super enthusiastically and starts dancing with him. Kind of seriously, kind of joking, but then he kind of catches that the other guy's like super into it. He starts actually getting into it instead of like being jokey about it. And then a third guy, and then a 5, 6, 8, 9, 10, and then all of a sudden there's like 100 people dancing like mad because this one guy kind of put it out there.
Yeah.
And there's a whole TED talk that was done on this video. And they said that the most important person wasn't the guy who started it necessarily. It's the first person to join.
Right.
Yeah.
Right? It's the powerful first follower that creates the trend. And one of my favorite parts about this particular scene is that Penny is the second one to sing.
Yep.
And it plays into the idea that, like, she is the band-aid, right, that holds the group together, that pushes these moments forward, that recognizes that there needed to be a follower for the unity of the group to come back. They're like that glue that holds everyone together. And I thought they kind of make that as, she talks about it as being a band-aid, not a groupie, and what the difference is. And I thought this specific scene and her doing that, being the second one to join in and to get everyone else to go, specifically showed that role that she claims to play for the band, or bands, because she does it apparently for lots of bands, in this scene. And apparently she's based on an actual real person. There was a bunch of people who were like this. But I thought it was really interesting that, they cut right to Vern Williams sitting there, and she's the second one to say, and she's kind of looking around the bus like, come on, guys, let's do it. And then it kind of pushes that ball forward. I don't know. Maybe I think too deeply on these things, but I thought...
I agree. Absolutely, I think it matters that she's the first one to join in, even before Jeff, who's like the singer.
Yeah, so he's the, and then funny enough, on that TED talk, the third follower is super important as well. Not quite as important as the first, but the first follower breaks the first wall down, and the second follower shows everyone else that it's okay to join. So I just thought that he, being the front man, is the one leading the rest of the band.
Well, and the third one, like the video you were talking about, the third one turns it into, this is a real thing. That first, the guy you're talking about, he comes up and is like dancing ironically, being silly. Once that turns into a real serious thing, everyone can just dance.
Yep.
Everyone can just sing.
Absolutely.
Have a good time.
And you mentioned Penny, there being a real person that was an inspiration. It's actually kind of similar to Stillwater. It's kind of like three different women. Right. That were the inspiration. Penny Ann Trumbull and Pamela DeBars and B.B. Buell. And Pamela is actually someone that's on our Pantheon Podcast Network, has her own show.
Oh, get the hell out of here.
So you should check that out if you're pretty into this movie.
I am.
As you've claimed. I'd suggest that podcast on the Pantheon.
Have you guys had her on to talk about?
No, but definitely looking forward to it. And I have a couple other lined up for that do the Muses podcast. So that's obviously taking a bit from this show as well. That they're the Muse.
I would love to hear that interview. That would be super cool.
And actually, one thing that's also again back to before that like 10-12 second mark when Larry first starts singing. And that's after the first line, what have you, of the song is sung by Elton, the Jesus Freaks Out in the Street. And the handing tickets is when he comes in. It's interesting that, it's not like right off the bat he decided to sing. And then something else I kind of wondered about, if you two had thoughts on, other songs and movies that are sung along to, and you can actually hear them singing too, because that's whenever it cuts to someone, you can definitely hear them all singing at some different points, but whenever it does cut to the new person, it's definitely focused.
You
on
can
that
definitely
voice.
Hear them,
that's the highest in the mix at least at that point. And then it goes back down a little bit for other new people.
Yeah, I don't know if I remember any where they actually have you hear their voice, or if it's like a group like this. Like you'll have individual people maybe hum along to a tune in a scene, but not where it's like a group of people singing. We actually hear their voice. And the only thing that's really popping in my mind right now at all is Wayne's Bohemian Rhapsody. But I don't know that you had there. That's more of like a lip sync thing.
They're more dancing to it than singing.
Yeah, I don't know that you can hear them singing as much.
For some reason, I thought of the scene in Titanic where they're in the church service because they're singing, I think it's Nearer My God to Thee, and as it pans across, you can hear Kate Winslet's voice when the camera's on her. So it's like they focused in the sound. But that's a very different kind of song and scene.
Yeah, I have to say, I'm just, as fond as this movie I am, is the polar opposite for that movie.
The bigger one to me, especially since the actor for the other one has kind of gone down in my mind, in Magnolia.
Yes.
With the Amy Mann.
Oh, right.
Song.
Yes.
Is it Save Me or is it the other one?
Save Me, yeah.
Yes. Where it's a little more surreal, too, because it's all these people that are separated that are each taking part and singing and you're hearing their voice and so forth.
Yeah, that's a good one.
But then the other one was in the car singing by I almost hate to say his name, Kevin Spacey in American Beauty to the Seeker.
Oh yeah.
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 And him, I think, even though he is a singer or was a singer, whatever, he had some of those chops. I think he kind of purposefully is singing a little off. not fully throughout that. Scene.
So there was a really kind of dumb movie that came out when I was in college that me and a bunch of my friends went to see because it was a Denzel movie, but they do that. It was a movie called Fallen.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes.
Oh,
yes.
And where the devil passes from one person to the other.
Time is on my side.
And it just goes from one.
John Goodman.
Yeah.
I was just playing that song right before we started this recording.
Yeah. It's kind of.
And I'm like, no, that song was ruined by that movie.
It was cool. That scene was cool. The movie wasn't great itself. I mean, it has an amazing cast. I don't know. It just isn't. Some of my favorite actors of all time, actually. Denzel, John Goodman, Donald Sutherland, James Gandolfini, and Elias Koteas. Like, that's a murderer.
Yeah, it's a good cast.
Yeah. But the idea was good. The execution wasn't great. But
right.
Yeah, so then there's a couple points when it cuts over to Jason Lee as Jeff Beebe, and he's very much the doing the lead singer thing of closing your eyes while singing, you know.
I definitely do
really
that.
Feeling it so much that
my wife gets mad at me when I'm driving.
and then there's the cut back over to. To Ed playing his legs still and even the curtains and at one point, but he's just got everyone's just starting to turn on these smiles, you know, very gradually. And he's, I think he's pretty happy, you know, I mean, having been, even though it was first sung by Larry, he was the one to kind of really start off the mimicking
that drumming
in a way, the playing along in some way.
Yeah, well, that is the unifying moment. It's so good. It's one of my favorite movie scenes, I think, ever.
All the while, there's one of the, I think, the two roadies that are on the bus, at least at this time. He's standing up in the back, kind of at their kitchenette, maybe, I think. Because there is this can and aluminum foil right behind William and Penny. But he seems to be making something or fixing his lunch. and I
breakfast
recently even
at that point.
What's that? Oh yeah, well, yeah,
breakfast.
Yeah,
breakfast.
Yes. It's just hard to say. But I even just was in communication on Instagram with one of the actors, very very low key, but of one of the other roadies that was in that. At least he was in at least the scene. The two scenes, the scene with the when they're coming out of the convenience store, then throw the bags of chips or whatever. And he was one of those guys. I asked him if he was one of those guys, but he actually said something in response to my post on Instagram, where I had the screenshot of him sitting in the background in that backstage area. And he's, you know, like a guitar tech roadie type guy.
Nice.
Way in the background. He says, "Hey, that's me."
That's pretty cool.
I talked with him a little bit.
I love that this sequence, especially because, as I said last time, in the script is so simple. It's just a paragraph. But here it's like it's building up along with the song because it keeps cutting to different people reacting and then joining in. It goes back to Russell and he's still not singing, but you can tell he's kind of paying attention. Uh-huh. And Beth joins in and Ed's having a good time. Takes a while for William to sing too, but he finally does. It's nice.
Yeah, you get a little glimpse into each one of the characters,
mm-hmm.
And their way that they join in.
That's even Dick cool. sings along, even though his arm is up, so you can barely see that he's doing it.
Well, yeah, and there's a reason for that, is because he couldn't, he felt like, I think, that he couldn't sing very well. He's not ever meant to be part of a band. As far as I know, he doesn't play an instrument, but he also doesn't sing well. So he said, he and Cameron apparently talked, and he said, "I'm just going to keep my arm here in front of my face because I'm not sure if I'm going to be doing this good enough." but he does tap his finger on the
bass.
Yeah. So that's something I do. I do a lot myself when I'm in mixed company. I go full bore when I'm alone driving back and forth to work and other places in my car.
Oh yeah, I'll be drumming on the steering wheel,
but
singing
but,
along.
Yeah, with other people around, I'll keep it pretty quiet usually. Unless, like you say, Mike, if someone else starts,
then, okay, there you go.
Yeah.
Yeah, did you see there was a video actually that came out recently of some dude who was singing Living on a Prayer?
Oh. Huh.
It was some dude sitting in like Central Park, sitting on the bench singing it by himself. And then one person joins in, and all of a sudden, in like a couple minutes, this whole park is just a cappella singing Living on a Prayer. This guy was just by himself, chilling out on the bench, singing it. It's a pretty cool video. Those are that kind of infectious, camaraderie among people, like just randomly, is really fun to see.
Well, are there any more thoughts on this minute in particular? I mean, certainly it's expanded over between the end of last minute and the beginning of next, but
I don't know how much you want to talk about the song itself.
Yeah, hey, definitely.
There's a line from Bernie Taupin. It's quoted in a bunch of sources, so I don't know where it originally came from, where he's talking about writing it. Because he dedicated it to Maxine Fiebelman, who he married. Yeah. And she was the seamstress for the band.
Yeah.
But he's like talking about how it really was just about all the girls in California when they came out here. Because he says, sunshine radiated from the populace. I was trying to capture the spirit of the time encapsulated by the women we met. Especially at clothes stores up and down the strip in L.A. They were free spirits, sexy in hip huggers and lacy blouses. And very ethereal the way they moved. So different from what I've been used to in England. And they all wanted to sew patches on your jeans, which Maxie did. They'd mother you and sleep with you. It was the perfect Oedipal complex. Which is very much Penny Lane in this. That's how she dresses. That's what she is. And all of them. I was surprised rewatching the movie just this week. How many of them wear like see-through shirts constantly. I'm like, oh, okay. I mean, I know it's the 70s, but wow.
I think, didn't everyone have, like, a Penny Lane type? Whether it was, like, high school or middle school or something. This girl who seemed, like, almost like a fairy or ephemeral. Just like this.
If you're lucky.
You know what I mean? Like just to see from afar and be, like, in love with because she was just too cool for you. I always, how William felt, you know, I think that's how he felt with a lot of it. It was just, and then he would get close to her and then obviously fall hard for her. But it was just that whole like hippie chick kind of like has mm-hmm. it together, but is still like cool. I don't know. I found that most of the guys of my age group, that I know had someone like that in their life that they could point to.
Definitely.
Well, in that age, that or that time period of middle school, high school, you know, I mean, for me, that's essentially, you know, very, very, very late 80s into the mid 90s. And it was just, I mean, I don't know if you just, you know, 5 to 10 years before that, 5 to 10 years after that, but I feel like that was just such a strong, you know, resurrection of the 60s, you know, kind of hippie
feel. I went to high school. I started high school in 91 and I finished college in 99. So I was a 90s kid. And two Woodstocks happened in the 90s, 94 and 99. So yeah, there was definitely a resurgence of like the 60s, 70s thing. Another one of my favorite movies of all time is Days of Confused, which, you know, it could fit into this universe very nicely.
Finally, for the song Tiny Dancer, I'll mention it here that it was released in 72, so it certainly fits. There's been a couple other songs here or there where, you know, between the albums that William was going through in roughly 69-ish, and then you know, songs that we've heard in this time frame of the movie 73 that were a little out of place, just a good year or two at the most.
Yeah, this one's fine.
That sat out, but this certainly worked well for being one of the biggest songs that went on. You know, it's hard to say. I mean, it seems like Cameron Crowe probably had a feeling. You know, I mean, he did what he did during this scene, I think, to try to make it what it's become to be.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, originally, you know, it only made it to number 41 on the charts because it was too long.
Yeah,
like. If there was a radio edit that took out a bunch of the good parts, and it was like, took out the opening music and part of the lyrics, and so it took a while for it to catch on. But this movie definitely gave it a resurgence. Uh-huh. Years later, what, 30 years after the fact, right?
Who cares about the chart? Some of the best music ever written never saw a chart ever.
True, and true.
I know it is. It's one of the.
I think in the 70s, that's a big thing.
Have you guys talked at all about the, I know that we mentioned like the four bands that made up, you know, that are speculated to have made up the band, and you had me rank them, but have you guys talked much about, and I know we don't have it in these minutes, but I just curious about how really good Stillwater is as a band.
Hmm.
Like that Fever Dog song is killer. The soundtrack for that movie has a couple of songs on it from them. And it is. I mean, obviously, Peter Frampton wrote it, right? Peter Frampton wrote it. And,
and with Nancy a bit,
Nancy Wilson.
Well, Cameron Crowe, even.
I mean, you're talking about, I don't know about rock royalty, but goddamn close, if not. And you've got a good writing staff. But still, that Fever Dog song is killer.
Yeah, I think that really is the standout. The we've had in the, what we've heard in the movie soundtrack itself. Proper that, you know, there's just very, very way off in the distance in the background for a couple of the songs that are supposed to be Stillwater songs, yet they really sound a bit too 90s to me. So it made perfect sense that they'd put those, you know, just as just some extra sound of a concert going on behind everyone.
Yeah, we never hear a whole song from them.
But yeah, I mean, and that's such a big thing, though, is it's the 60s, 70s, all the way is littered with one hit wonders, and I'm not saying that Stillwater, you know, we don't know much beside this. They're coming out with a third album around this tour. You know, we don't know anything about any kind of whether they've had chart success or, you know, if radio airplay, you know, we're not given any of those details, right. So it's so hard to say what any other songs could have really been doing, you know, but how well they really could have been. But I mean, just based on that one song, it is that they I mean, it's a band worth I think listening to more, you know.
Yeah, and I would be, if that was a real band, I'd probably be a fan.
it's got the right attitude, a somewhat Zeppelinish attitude, I think, that song especially.
Yeah,
between the few songs that we are aware of, but But like I say, it seems like a couple of them at least are just too 90s sounding to me. Not that that's an awful thing, but it's just not as realistic as it could be.
Just think of that as that's why they're not big.
Yeah.
Because they're ahead of their time.
Yeah, right. They're ahead of their time, right. See, I'm very familiar with, I love the soundtrack, not the score, CD album for the Beatles movie Backbeat.
Oh.
So that's when they're in Hamburg is what it mostly, almost solely focuses on. And it's only the songs that they were covering then. It's nothing that they had written themselves that is used. But it's all done by, because it came out in 94, I think. It's all done by, at least the two Daves, Dave Grohl and Dave Perner. And, two or three other of the alternative grunge scene guys. And I think they capture, because it's a good 12, 14 or so songs. I think they hit on that, almost very, very, very proto-punk, kind of feel that the Beatles kind of, from what I've heard a bit, especially when the anthology came out, what they hit on or what they were doing, what the Beatles were kind of doing with that in Germany with Germans, whether they're, soldiers not so good, criminals of sorts hanging out in these bars that they were performing in with these cages, and throwing beer bottles and things at them and really toughing them up and getting them ready to play.
That's the stuff that Malcolm Gladwell writes about in Tipping Point, I think, where he's talking about how the Beatles spent so much time just playing over and over when they were in Germany. And it made them capable of what they were going to do later.
I like Malcolm. He's good. Good writer.
Well, are there any other notes before we get to the next minute?
I think I'm good.
No, just, I think you mentioned it, but we end with Russell smiling at the end. So it's nice. Still hasn't joined in, but he's smiling.
Yeah, it's a good 20 seconds between the last shot and the previous shot where he's not even smiling, but I think you mentioned, Mike, that he has this kind of realization. Oh, there's something special going on here, I think.
Mm-hmm.
What's going to happen here? What am I going to do?
Well, the way the script says it, where'd that line go? Like it or not, this is his family.
Yeah. But he's smiling, almost laughing, kind of, and even putting his head down at the very last second before our minute ends. It's the kind of thing that it makes you feel good when people around you think, people that you are your chosen family, not your given.
Yes.
Yep. Any further plugs? I know, Robert, your other shows, your multiple shows, similar to me.
Yeah, I figured I'd promote Annihilation Minute today. It's up every Thursday. 1 minute of Annihilation with a hell of a lot of pre-written research and sidetracks and musical interludes, and those episodes get very strange.
Yeah, you talk about the book some. You bring elements of the book at points.
And other books and other movies, and it gets weird and goes in strange directions, and I love it.
And I don't really have anything. Yep. You're welcome to go back and listen to the old episodes of the Casting Couch. They're on Apple, pretty much anywhere you can get podcasts still. They're all out there.
Is there any way that on social media that whether it's for that show or your personally, if you
want to give out? We still have the show. We still have it up. Our Twitter, we're not nearly as active as we used to be, but we still interact because we have a lot of friends on there that we.
Oh, yeah, sure. Things come up and you talk about.
The movie podcast, community, a lot of people helping each other out, so which is pretty cool.
Yeah.
We always like that. So, and that's just at Recasting Couch.
Okay.
Or Recasting Pod, sorry, at Recasting Pod, sorry.
And I'll give my Twitter for this show is at Almost Famous Men. It's actually the same also on Instagram. And like I mentioned yesterday, I think Facebook, we have our Facebook page, which is at facebook.com/AlmostFamousMinute. And you can find our group. It's the Band-Aids Listener Society. And that's where I prefer to talk long form, you know. But every now and then I post things besides just the show itself. I'll post on Twitter a bit too. You can always have a discussion there. So thanks so much, guys. So this was Minute 62, and really hope to have both Robert and Mike, or at least one of them, I would hope, back for Minute 63 next time. Otherwise, I think we got in everything we wanted to talk about. Okay, so next week will be Minute 63 nonetheless, and see you then. Until then, it's all happening.
It's all happening.
I am a golden god! Yeah! Yes, yeah! And I was born in the backseat of a Greyhound bus, rolling down Highway 41. You know the Queen of Hearts is always your best bet.